So I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Professor Aaron Brunbat, who is Assistant Professor of South Asian Religions in the Religious Studies Department at St. Lawrence University. He did his PhD in Toronto, so he's moved south, if my geography is correct. And his research has been on the Swami Narayan tradition. That becomes examples of the ways in which a tradition forms itself, which I thought was a very interesting project in the contemporary world. And so he's published several things. Among his publications are the Swami Narayan Commentarial Tradition, in a book edited by Raymond Williams and Yogi Trivedi, and the BAP Swami Narayan Community in Global Religious Movements Across Borders, Sacred Service, in a book edited by Helen Ebau and Stephen Cherry. He's also been awarded various scholarships, including a prestigious Fulbright and Andrew Mellon scholarships, and this afternoon he'll speak about A Quarrelsome Foe, Late Colonial Negotiations, a Vaidik Atwar.
Thank you very much for that introduction. This talk today is a part of a broader book project I'm working on, which is tentatively called Debating Sanskrit, the Scholastic Imperative in Modern Hinduism. And it is thinking through all things scholastic and all things Sanskrit, particularly as relates to the Swaminarayan tradition. And so this talk today is one part of that work, and I'll sort of make connections to the other things that I'm working on as I move through that. So since the 1887 publication of William Joseph Wilkins' Modern Hinduism, scholars of religion in South Asia have tried to identify and analyze the modernity of religious traditions, particularly as brought on by the transformative engagement with European colonialism. Post-colonial scholarship has traced how a teleology is often read into colonial modernity. Namely, there is a stagist periodization in which European modernity represents the apex to be reached by all others. Non-Europeans can thus only be rendered modern through an engagement with Enlightenment-based concerns, or else be relegated to the waiting room of history, in Dipesh Chakrabarty's terms. Although calls to provincialize this universalist history of European modernity from post-colonial thinkers like Chakrabarty are over two decades old, the project is still ongoing. Too often, still, the colonial period is envisioned as a moment of radical rupture, obfuscating those agents who sought an active, albeit mediated, connection with the past. Even now, we must ask what other stories we can hear when we listen to different voices in modernity. Today, I'll tell one such story set in modernity, whose characters complicate easy binaries between the traditional and the modern. It is the story of the consolidation of a new religious community and its attempt to mediate local conflict through a translocal appeal to what I call a scholastic public. This is the story of the Swaminarayan religious community in Western India, which is situated at the transition to colonial rule. So all of you know this map of colonial India, but unlike other parts of India, the British made inroads into Gujarat relatively late, with the expansion of the Bombay Presidency in the early 19th century. And as you can see from this map, the yellow parts of Gujarat, so Gujarat, obviously it's on the west, but the yellow parts are still princely states that had sort of nominal connections to the pink parts, which were the part of the Bombay Presidency. Now, after providing a brief introduction to the Swaminarayan community, I will describe a dispute the community was mired in at the turn of the 20th century. In doing so, I will examine how this modern community engages in a complex negotiation of the notions of orthodoxy and tradition, all while taking advantage of recent advances in print technology occasioned by the colonial state. At the turn of the 19th century, a man named Sajanand Swami took over leadership of a small ashrama in western Kathiawar in present-day Gujarat. By the time of his death 30 years later, his Swaminarayan community had attracted a large following composed of monks and laypeople from all across Gujarat, Kathiawar, and Kutch. The sampradaya grew steadily over the 30-year period of Sajanand Swami's teachings, with colonial officials estimating a membership in the hundreds of thousands. Much of the institutionalization of the community took place during the last 10 years of his life, which saw the construction of six temples, the establishment of offices of administration, and the production of a variety of texts. The Swaminarayan community is now a dynamic and rapidly growing transnational community with multiple and diverse sects. One of those sects, the BAPS Sampradaya, has constructed this temple in Neasden in northwest London in 1995. Though the Sampradaya saw steady growth in the 19th century, accounts of these early years from within the Sampradaya and in colonial sources reveal frequent tension with other religious groups. This tension was due in part to the very growth of the Swaminarayan Sampradaya, but also its novel theological and devotional tenets. For example, the Sampradaya worshipped Sajanan Swami not just as a guru or teacher, but as the human manifestation of God. One of the ways the community sought to authorize these novel beliefs and practices was through the time-honored practice of Shastartha, public debate and disputation. Now, the literal translation of Shastartha is, of course, meaning of scripture, the implication being that the winner of the debate was able to adequately interpret the true meaning of a scriptural text. Accounts of various public disputations are found throughout Swaminarayan literature. This is most prominent in a 19th century text called the Sri Hari Digvijay, Sajanan Swami's Conquest in All Four Directions. This text laid out in dramatic fashion, and at times with questionable historicity, a variety of public disputations with a host of intellectual and religious others. These accounts describe debates focused on Vedanta, the correct interpretation of Vaishnava texts, and other scholastic concerns. I have here a print from, or a plate from a 1934 edition of that text, the Sri Digvijaya, which has Sajanan Swami's Shastartha at the court of Sayajirao Gayakwad. Now, of course, some of these elements here are from a devotional perspective. At the court of the king, you see him on the right seated below Sajanan Swami, which probably would not have been the case if this were, you know, a representation of the actual debate. But, you know, so this is almost 100 years after the text was first authored, and so certainly a devotional rendition of that. Now, in addition to this text, other historical sources from the early 20th century describe three public debates. The first two took place in the 19th century at the royal court of the Gayakwad dynasty in Baroda, so same court, but different interlocutors. The third took place further afield, in 1907, in the sacred city of Banaras, Kashi. In the remainder of my talk today, I will analyze this latter disputation. I suggest that while it represents a continuity of sorts with the disputations robustly described in the Sri Hari Digvijaya, there are notable differences, indicative of the Swaminarayan Sampradaya's active negotiations of orthodoxy. Now, the term that I am loosely translating as orthodoxy is Vaidikatva, being Vedic. Referring to the earliest strata of Hindu texts, the Vedas. This is a broad term, particularly since the Vedas themselves are broad and esoteric. The uses of the categories of Vaidika and Avaidika are usually deliberate and strategic. As we'll see, even in the 19th century, there are multiple mobilizations of the concept. Furthermore, I suggest that the relative modernity of these debates about orthodoxy must be understood alongside two considerations. Firstly, the use of modern genres of print to amplify the debates. And secondly, the reliance on external associational bodies of pundits to adjudicate the debates. I argue that there are two very different deployments of orthodoxy at play. In the first case, the newly formed associational bodies were pursuing transsectarian agendas of defining orthodoxy for a nationalist goal of challenging colonial critiques of Hinduism. In the second, Swaminarayan agents were defending the legitimacy of their community through recourse to the symbolic purchase of Vaidikatva. Crucially, they viewed this Vaidikatva not as narrowly defined, but as pluralistic in nature. The 1907 disputation affected lay Brahmin members of the Swaminarayan community, but by extension, the community as a whole. The Swaminarayan Sampradaya drew its membership from a range of class and caste. Recent scholarship surveying British accounts and the community's hagiographical literature argues for a strategic accommodation in caste practices in the Swaminarayan tradition, whereby caste identity was not totally removed, but membership within a fellowship was emphasized across caste divisions, rooted in an understanding of the ontological self as devoid of societal differentiations. This resulted in an encouragement, especially amongst Brahmins, to forgo caste-based commensality restrictions. One could join in a communal meal as they saw fit. As I will demonstrate, it is in part because of these considerations of caste that more conservative Brahmins, lay and monastic, challenged the Swaminarayan community's Brahmins. Though the community was hardly Brahmin-centered, the challenges to the broader perception of the community as non-Vedic affected all members of the community. The opponent was a monk named Madhava Tirtha, who held a powerful position as the head of an important monastic institution located in the pilgrimage town of Dwarka in western Kathiawad, the Sharda Pit. I've indicated that there for those who are might not be as familiar with Gujarat. This has long been recognized as one of four principal monasteries associated with the 8th century theologian Shankara, the chief proponent of the influential school of Advaita Vedanta. Accordingly, the heads of the four institutions are called Shankaracharyas. The four institutions are spread across the length and breadth of the Indian subcontinent in each of the cardinal directions. Dwarka is the western seat. Historians have questioned the actual link of these four institutions with Shankara, suggesting that they are early modern formations. Nonetheless, by the modern period, these monasteries were endowed with formidable clout. The monastic heads of these institutions are known for their conservative tendencies and their maintenance of strict caste regulations. At the turn of the 20th century, Madhava Tirtha, as the head of the Dwarka, at the head of the Dwarka Pita, held considerable power in the area as an upholder of Brahminic orthodoxy. Moreover, Madhava Tirtha appears to have been a particularly quarrelsome figure during his 15-year tenure as monastic head. Court records reveal that he litigated a dispute with a rival figure. This rival figure had claimed to be a Shankaracharya and set up another monastery in eastern Gujarat. Madhava Tirtha claimed in the lawsuit that he had, quote, throughout the part of India where Gujarati is spoken, the exclusive privilege of preaching as a Shankaracharya, end quote. This is a position that the Bombay High Court agreed to in 1908. Madhava Tirtha also feuded with the Maratha king Sayajirao Gayakwad III, who controlled Dwarka as part of his holdings in western Kathiawar. At some point during his tenure, Madhava Tirtha shifted his residence from Dwarka to Dakor. You see that in sort of on the right of the screen. Located in the Kheda district in between Ahmedabad and Baroda. It is said that this was because Madhava Tirtha was a man of rigid orthodoxy who, quote, refused to accept various laws for social reform passed by Sayajirao Gayakwad. Right, so rather than be under the purview of the Gayakwad, he shifted his seat temporarily. Here in Kheda district, members of the Swaminarayan community found themselves in Madhava Tirtha's crosshairs, particularly because of their renegotiation of caste relations. Specifically, Madhava Tirtha proclaimed that Swaminarayan Brahmins were avaidika, because they were in violation of Varnashrama Dharma, the code of conduct rooted in caste and stage in life. Consequently, he released public letters forbidding 11-fold contact with Swaminarayan Brahmins. The ripples of this were felt amongst Brahmins, monks, and the broader Swaminarayan community. This debate spilled forth onto the pages of public letters and pamphlets, whose reach was significantly increased by the introduction of print technologies in Gujarat a few decades earlier. The first extant document is a two-page pamphlet entitled Refutation of Madhava Tirtha's Letter, dating to August 1907. Written by a Brahmin monk in the Swaminarayan Sampradaya, the pamphlet is a scathing rejoinder to Madhava Tirtha's criticisms of the Swaminarayans in the public letter that he circulated a month earlier. The monk explicitly defines his audience for the letter, people who, quote, love only truth, are unbiased, are leaders among Vaishnavas and Smarthas, and are well-learned, end quote. The monk is thus envisioning a broad, educated scholastic public within which to air the community's grievances, corroborated by the fact that his letter was composed in Sanskrit. His stated objective is to inform these people about the actions of Madhava Tirtha, who is, quote, fond of all sorts of quarrel. The Swaminarayan monk claims, Many letters have been sent by our followers in order to fix a time for debate with him, with the desire to propound our religious organization as eternal and well adorned by the scriptures. Nevertheless, he enters the forest of great debate with fear, and has refused to accept a time for debate. He is fearful, like a deer in front of a lion, and rather than teaching the truth of Dharma, he thinks that causing strife within a community is the best teaching. Hyperbole aside, the monk is suggesting here that Madhavatirtha refuses to meet in person for a public disputation, but persists in calling the Swaminarayan community avaidika, in both oral and written form. The remainder of the letter is part invective and part refutation of Madhavatirtha's arguments. The first of Madhavatirtha's charges is that the community is worshipping a false teacher. Being a true teacher requires authorship of classical commentaries on ancient canonical texts, something missing from Sajanan Swami's oeuvre. The monk counters in this tract that this attribute is, quote, merely boasting of one's prowess, and there are no authoritative references about this found anywhere. Now, in my broader work, I engage this sort of concern about the lack of commentaries and the attempts by various members of the Swaminarayan Sampradaya to compose these commentaries, starting in the early 19th century, continuing into the early 20th century, and continuing on to the present day. Now, back to this. According to this pamphlet, Madhavatirtha's original letter gave several reasons why the Swaminarayan community could be seen to be contrary to the teachings of the Vedas. The pamphlet, in turn, responds to each of the allegations. In the process, it contends that the mode of worship in the Swaminarayan community is indeed expounded in the Vedas, that Sajanan Swami knew the purport of the Vedas, and the community's practices are in accordance with Dharma. Circulation figures for the pamphlet are unknown, but its author clearly hoped to decisively refute Madhavatirtha in a scholastic public. Spoiler alert, he was not successful. A few months after this, members of the Swaminarayan community felt compelled to escalate. They appealed to another seat of authority, the recently formed Bharat Dharma Mahamandal, located in Banaras. Subsequently, in November of 1907, the Bharat Dharma Mahamandal, I'll refer to it as BDM from now on, passed several resolutions affirming that the Swaminarayan community was Vaidika. Moreover, immediately after the BDM resolved in favor of the Swaminarayans, members of the Swaminarayan community from Bombay published a small tract detailing the events called The Resolution Regarding the Vaidikatva of the Sri Swaminarayan Sampradaya Arrived at by the Great Pandits of Kashi. The tract is mostly in Gujarati, suggesting that it was appealing to a broader base than the previous Sanskrit pamphlet. In describing the lead-up to the resolution, the tract repeats the other pamphlet's claims. It states that Madhavatirtha had caused great agitation by saying that the community is avaidika, and that on behalf of the entire community, monks and scholars, quote, have repeatedly invited him to prove the things that he has said, done, and written, unquote. A new allegation is that Madhavatirtha initially agreed to meet, but then did not respond to requests for deciding a time and venue. Frustrated by the situation, members of the community sent copies of the Shiksha Patri, the community's code of conduct attributed to Sajanan Swami, to the Bombay branch of the BDM. It was subsequently forwarded to the broader BDM membership in Banaras, which met in November 1907 to make its resolution. Over various meetings in November 1907, the BDM passed a total of 6 resolutions in support of the Swaminarayans. The published tract included a translation of these resolutions. I won't get into the specifics of the resolutions beyond pointing out that they represent differences in opinion and further debate before the 6th and final resolution. The tract describes all of these resolutions and their various backgrounds. Ultimately, the tract is quite clear about why it is publishing such a detailed, thorough account of the proceedings. We've created this small book describing the resolution arrived at regarding the purity and excellence of our community by great scholars so that Madhavatirtha ceases this baseless nuisance, thereby halting the increase of his infamy by his own hands. It was not enough that the BDM resolved in favor of the Swaminarayans, but rather the entire story, the resolution, and external corroboration of this had to be published and disseminated. What was the verdict? Were they successful? One other text reveals that the previous tract was not immediately as effective as hoped. In February 1908, roughly 2.5 months after the BDM resolutions, an open letter to Madhavatirtha was published by Brahmins residing in Umret, located a mere 5 miles from Madhavatirtha's new center at Dakor. Again, many of the themes from the previous publications are present. Madhavatirtha's pronouncements resulting in the ostracizing of Swaminarayan Brahmins and his stated desire of debating Swaminarayans, but dropping out at the last minute. The Brahmins lay down the gauntlet. We're making it well known that we're ready to debate. If it's true, as you say, that you're prepared to put down a deposit of 5,000 rupees, we're also prepared to put down a deposit of 5,000 rupees for a venue. If you really have the desire, as you say, to discuss your points and your actions honestly in front of an adjudicator, then within 5 days, give us the names of 2 or 3 intermediaries, and then we'll name our intermediaries within another 5 days. Between them, they'll name one adjudicator. Our intermediaries will select a date for the sabha between 45 to 60 days from the day we receive your reply. By providing a preponderance of details and logistical considerations, the Brahmins are attempting to show that they are serious about confronting Madhavatirtha head-on. This is the final document discussing the matter from the period I've been able to track down. Popular history suggests that while he didn't agree to the public debate, he did eventually ease up on his proclamations before his death 8 years later. Now, to summarize the foregoing discussion, the dispute shows the increasing employment of print technologies to engage broad publics. All three of these documents, published within months of each other between 1907 to 1908, are indicative of how the Swaminarayan Sampradaya made use of this new technology for the purpose of defending their community and their place within this public. However, it is not merely modern technologies that give this debate over orthodoxy a modern flair. In appealing to Banaras, Kashi, the Swaminarayans were certainly drawing upon the translocal prestige of Kashi. This was a town renowned for its scholastic rigor and has been called by some as the Athens of India. The practice of debate was also central to the city. One of the most prominent temples in Banaras, which was alternatively raised and reconstructed based on the shifting dynamics of rule, had a large hall expressly meant for public debate, the Mukti Mandapam. However, the BDM was representative of a modern development of this tradition. It was one of a network of associational bodies that began to emerge in the wake of the colonial critique of Hinduism. Now, I've listed several groups here, but the ones that I'm focused on, for my purposes, are groups including the Arya Samaj and various Sanatana Dharma groups in late colonial North India. A little background, many of you might be familiar with this, but in case you are not, Dayanand Saraswati was a man who became popular in North India in the late 19th century because of his exhortations to return Hindu traditions to their Vedic roots, shorn of centuries worth of accretions in the shape of image worship, Puranic lore, and sectarianism. Crucially, his work is generally considered a reaction to colonial and missionary critiques of Hinduism, which, as you can probably surmise, well, as many of you probably know, but you can surmise from Saraswati's proclamations, these were generally that, Hindus were polytheistic, they are sort of regressive, backwards, and that all of these sectarian groups, the Vaishnavas, Shaivas, etc., are sort of in this internecine conflict, right? That is what Dayanand was responding to. His thoughts drew the ire of more traditional-minded scholars unwilling to make those concessions. Dayanand founded an associational body called the Arya Samaj and frequently used public debate to spread his message. One account describes a seminal debate in Banaras between Dayanand and as many as 300 pundits, led by the court pundit of the king of Banaras. The group of pundits claim victory in the debate, based in part on Dayanand's inability to cite Vedic sources from memory. However, leading newspapers in both English and Hindi continued to discuss the debate for months, and Dayanand published tracts outlining a more sustained response to the pundits after the fact. This Banaras debate and its aftermath are emblematic of the very public way in which being Vaidika was debated in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Voices of orthodox concern arose to counter the criticisms of Dayanand Saraswati, as well as those of colonial missionaries. a host of Sanatana Dharma Sabhas developed, associational bodies dedicated to the defense of the eternal Hindu tradition. Further, these public debates were publicized and elaborated in tracts, pamphlets, and periodicals. This is where the BDM fits in. It was one such association of educated men initially formed in 1889 by a man named Dindayalu Sharma, and was envisioned in theory as a transsectarian religious body aimed at religious reform and the protection of Varnashrama Dharma. Further, it was seen as a broader collective to coordinate the efforts of various Sanatana Dharma Sabhas. It also attracted the patronage of Hindu kings and rulers. At its core, it was an associational body rooted in debate. The BDM sent out religious questionnaires to religious specialists in order to arrive at a consensus regarding issues flagged by the Arya Samaj as wide-ranging as Varnashrama Dharma to science and rationality. Further, the BDM solicited written questions regarding Hindu scriptural texts, including the Vedas and Puranas, to be discussed and answered by the group. In its opposition to colonial critique, the BDM was certainly reform-minded. However, it still reflected a project of supporting what some have called a symbolic orthodoxy, largely in opposition to the Arya Samaj. Drawing upon the work of historians like Chris Bailey, the scholar John Zavos makes the crucial point that although this orthodoxy seems to be rather traditional in outlook, rooted in an explicit connection with the past, it was nonetheless a category being constructed under late colonialism in markedly different ways. Contrary to pre-colonial articulations of orthodoxy, much more focused on regional inflections of community, Sanatana Dharma groups appealed to the nebulous symbolic power of orthodoxy to speak for Hinduism as a whole. This was then used to pursue anti-colonial nationalist agendas. In doing so, these groups took on a decidedly modern organizational structure, replete with things like constitutions and secretaries. Zavos argues that Sanatana Dharma groups, quote, in the name of orthodoxy and tradition, are accommodating and articulating wide-reaching changes, unquote. The Swaminarayan debates in 1907 render this already complex articulation of modernity even more complex. I suggest that the Swaminarayan debate is in a liminal space of sorts in terms of the two stages of conceptions of orthodoxy described by Zavos. Although they are making use of a newly configured scholastic public as occasioned by modern associational bodies, and they use modern print technologies to publicize these endeavors, members of the Swaminarayan community are not doing so in an attempt to speak for Hinduism as a whole in a transsectarian manner. Further, their concerns are disconnected from nationalist projects of responding to colonial critique. They seek to defend their community locally against powerful figures who deem their community to be non-Vedic. That is to say, they're not attempting to define an orthodoxy in the service of a transsectarian anti-colonial nationalist agenda. Rather, they're seeking to participate in this orthodoxy, to render their community viable and justifiable in a scholastic public. These Swaminarayan negotiations, especially the ones presented in Sanskrit, very conspicuously do not engage with colonial critique and do not engage in anti-colonial polemic. And yet they are authorized by and indebted to parallel scholastic considerations between the Arya Samaj and Sanatana Dharma groups that are rooted in the colonial encounter. As such, the Swaminarayan deployment of orthodoxy is much more in line with what Elaine Fisher has described as Hindu pluralism in early modern South India, where a host of groups do not need to cede their sectarian affiliation in order to participate in a broader Hindu collective. The Swaminarayan agents are not telling the Shankaracharya that their vision of religiosity is more Hindu than his. They are saying, we are Hindu too. I end my talk today with a brief coda describing a recent occurrence in the BAPS Swaminarayan community, one of the many groups that broke off from the original Swaminarayan community in light of doctrinal and successional disputes starting in the early 20th century. A few years ago, BAPS was felicitated by another association of pundits and scholars based in Benares called the Kashi Vidvat Parishad. This was in recognition of the recent authorship of classically styled Sanskrit texts by a BAPS monk named Bhadresh Swami. Once again, figures in the Swaminarayan community are appealing to a scholastic public, but to a different end. Here it is to authorize BAPS's interpretation of Sajanand Swami's teachings. Significant for our discussion is the manner in which news of this event was communicated to members of the BAPS community. Firstly, it was made a prominent entry on the international website of BAPS. A write-up of the event was presented in both Gujarati and English, along with 20 photos, and I have like kind of the screenshot of that here, and an edited 12-minute video. The write-up described the text Bhadra Swami had composed. It described the Kashi Vidvat Parishad, since many members of the community would have previously been unaware of it, and then it described in detail the proclamation issued by the Parishad. These Sanskrit texts are sacred texts on Sajanand Swami's revealed theology. Acclaimed by all scholars, respected Bhadra Swami is an acharya and a contemporary commentator in the lineage of classical commentators. Therefore, we all collectively endorse that this system of theology that has been revealed by Sajanand Swami is distinct from all other doctrines and is a Vedic system. Once again, there is an authentication of a Swaminarayan text by a group of Sanskrit pundits located in the seat of Sanskrit scholasticism, Banaras. Once again, this fact is communicated far and wide, but this time using new digital media rather than print media. Of course, it represents a different negotiation of tradition and orthodoxy from the case 100 years prior. There are a number of historical considerations that are worthy of further reflection, including the development of India as a nation state and the revolutionary nature of digital media. With all of these shifts in the contemporary period, not to mention the way the Swaminarayan community itself has changed, much more remains to be considered in understanding how negotiations of orthodoxy continue to take place.